Welcome to the C-Suite podcast that we're recording at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. I'm Russell Goldsmith, and together with Graham Barrett, we'll be chatting to a number of the speakers and attendees from the conference.
We're producing the show in partnership with Remote, the global HR platform, and we'll be recording the conversations on their booth here in the Creative Industries Expo. Really hope you enjoy this episode.
So I'm joined now by Donald Knight, the Chief People Officer at Greenhouse Software. Thanks so much for joining us, Donald.
Russell, man, look, thanks for having me, man. This is super exciting. I'm glad to talk to you.
I am very excited about this chat that we're going to have. Now, but you've already thrown me because I had on my notes here that you're a busy guy and you're doing two sessions here. You've just done a third. Well, you've got one tomorrow, but you've just done an impromptu one as well, haven't you?
I did, yeah. So yesterday we talked about AI, and then my buddy needed me to go do a talk at Delta, which was pretty phenomenal. They had a great activation, by the way. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about D&I Beyond Borders, Enterprise Ireland. It's going to be pretty amazing.
Well, let's start with the first one. So the session was how AI is shaping the employee experience. What are the biggest impacts that AI is having on the workplace at the moment?
Look, I think the first one, Russell, is like there's a lot of people that are viewing this through a sense of disruption, and there's a lot of angst around the tool, and I get it, right? Like if you think about any innovation that we've seen in the workplace, modern workplace, whether it's internet.com or even the laptop, like people were scared at first. I think the thing I try to do is frame it between three lenses. Number one, companies have to be able to define what is the AI policy they're going to have? How are they going to dispatch that tool inside of their own organization and almost create like a framing of what they want their folks to be able to use when it comes to AI? Because people are using it, whether it's sanctioned or not. So companies need to lean in on that. I think the second one is around employees. Like employees have to figure out, hey, if you don't become well-versed on these tools, you're going to end up finding out that you're not as impactful as you could be. Think about this. Like, remember the typewriter, and now we use laptops? If everybody that loved typewriters said we're never going to take on partnering with a laptop and learning how to use a laptop, well, they'd almost effectively be outside of a job today. So I think that's the second one. And then the third one for me is around individuals, which is how do you continue to upskill yourself and spend time on the tool for you personally to figure out how do you become more well-versed in AI and its applications in your day-to-day work. And so for me, I use it every day. It's the easiest way for me to catch up on all my emails because I get hundreds upon hundreds of emails a day. And so what I do is I go through, I star all the emails that are most important to me, and then I draft my reply in ChatGPT-4. And then it learns my tone and the way that I like to communicate with other humans. I post it into a Google Doc, change the formatting, review it one more time, and then I'm able to respond to literally hundreds of emails within an hour and a half. So
that's tremendous.
Yeah.
Listen, talking about the workplace, so my company, Audair, that produces the C-Suite podcast, we're a totally remote team.
Okay.
We're stood here on our partners for the podcast at South by Southwest, remote, okay? There's plenty of people, obviously, that enjoy hybrid working, but there are still some leaders now that are calling for us to come back to the office. What's your thoughts on terms of, you know, where we will be working in the future?
Yeah, I'll frame this two different ways. I'll say empathy and then reality. I have empathy for leaders who are calling people back into the workplace. And the reason I have empathy for them is they've only been successful one way. What probably most notable is Elon Musk, very successful in business. He's never had to go build an electric car or build a rocket with people being based in one country and he in his home office. So I have empathy for them because it could be a little, you know, daring for them to try to figure out how can I be as successful as I can be if I've only grown up with in-person collaboration, right? So that's the empathy. But here's the reality, right? The reality is, think about the multi-generational workforce that we have today. By 2030, 30% of the workforce will be made up of Gen Z. These are people that were going to school remotely.
Yeah.
Zoom and Google Meets and Microsoft Teams, these are like defaults for them. The other thing that we're seeing, right, is from a reality perspective, the dynamic between creating real value, like what does that look like for them? They want to be aligned to companies that are purposeful. And they don't believe just going into a cubicle so you can watch me do work is purposeful. And so I think the reality is we have to figure out, how do we create real team collaboration, whether it's asynchronously or in person? And what I've told people, on-site is the new off-site. When I was coming up in my career, I remember when my CHROs used to take us to these amazing places, whether it's a coffee shop or a beach or some team building activity, because that's where we found greater collaboration. Now we're going to see on-site being the new off-site, where you're bringing people together in meaningful ways in order for them to do collaboration. And it means that you have to be very mindful of the people experience that people have, whether they're going into one physical location or not. And so we took our company fully distributed, and I'm enjoying seeing people feel more fulfilled in what they're doing every day, regardless of how they're creating value, whether it's in person or remotely. So it's pretty cool.
You touched on Gen Z there. Obviously, we've now got Gen Alpha. I mean, how much influence are these guys going to have in that? You know, your company deals with hiring, you know, or helps people to hire. So what's the big influence that they're going to have in that process?
Yeah. So I would answer this two ways. The first way is we've seen job searches for roles that are remote up 62% year over year. Okay. So companies that are like, oh my goodness, I'm never going to think about remote or hybrid work. Okay. You're not going to be around, because this is what people are looking for.
Yeah.
You mentioned Gen Alpha. I feel very lucky. I told you this a little bit, but I have two children. My son was born in 2010 and my daughter was born last week.
I know, that is first. What? Congratulations.
Thank
and it's amazing.
You. Thank you. Yeah.
But after that, you're still.
I'm still here.
I know. Right?
I'm married very well. Shout out to my wife. But no, but they book in Gen Alpha.
Yeah.
My son and my daughter book in Gen Alpha. And so what I mean by that, the dynamics of their realities are very different from mine. Think about this. They're growing up in a world where AI is a default. Another one I use is, like, I remember when Facebook came to my campus, my son has grown up in a world where that company was called Meta. He doesn't even know it was called Facebook.
Yeah.
And so for me, like, you have to, as a company, you got to think about, what are the new realities for your talent pipeline of the future? And if you fail to innovate and try to figure out, how do you bring them in? How do you offer them things like remote work that they're prioritizing? Well, essentially you're planning to fail, right? The easiest way to talk about this is, go look at the Forbes 400 list in the 1950s and go look at it from last year. You'll see three trends. Trend number one, there were companies that were around in the 1950s. They're not around anymore. Circuit City, Toys R Us, not here. Fail to innovate. There's companies that are around today that weren't around in the 1950s. Snap, Meta, Airbnb, weren't even thought of.
Yeah.
But that third group, Russell, the ones that are able to figure this thing out, how do you constantly evolve? Those are the companies that I believe right now are trying to figure out, how do you keep that generation or these next generations engaged, regardless of how they're unlocking value for your company, whether in physical spaces or not. And so I'm excited about the generations that are coming. I'm also a little biased because I have two children. So.
Okay, let's move on to the second, your third session, but the second that I had on my notes,
yeah,
which is advancing corporate DE&I in a global context. So that's the one you're talking about tomorrow.
Yeah.
What's the secret in creating a truly inclusive culture, you know, on a global scale?
What is there only one secret? I think there's multiple secrets. Look, I think if you want to have a recipe of inclusion, it has to be rooted in four things: inclusion, diversity, equity, and allyship. So to me, inclusion is, there's an old saying, someone was saying, oh, you know, diversity is inviting multiple people to the party, but inclusion is asking them to dance. And at the time, that sounded revolutionary. And I was like, yeah, it sounds okay. But like, if I only ask you to dance one time, am I truly inclusive? Right? And so to me, if you really want to create that environment, you got to figure out, okay, when you're looking at things like employee engagement or employee sentiment, do they all have the same level of engagement? Because what I have found is, at companies where you may have 80% positive engagement, it changes when you start to look at different micro communities. Micro communities meaning people of color, gender, people with diverse abilities or neurodivergent. Like, how do you make sure that you're quantifying, keeping all of these folks engaged and not just zooming out and looking at the big positive statistic? The other thing for me is diversity of thought. I have found that the greatest innovations on this planet has happened when you get diverse people with different backgrounds together. And so you got to be able to figure out, how do you foster an environment for those people to thrive? And one of the easiest ways to do it is, like, think about Zoom calls where some of the most notable people are vocal and they're always speaking out, and we typically deem those people as extroverted and leaders. And I'm like, but how do you create an environment where the people that may not be speaking up as much also lend their voice, lend their insight, lend their perspective? And then the last one for me is really rooted in allyship, which I think is something that's super powerful globally. Allyship meaning realizing that people can look at the exact same event or the exact same experience and walk away with very different feelings. And how do you make sure that you foster an environment where they also feel like, hey, you want to be seen, valued, and heard? And so for me, that's probably a lot of the pieces I have in my recipe, at least at Greenhouse. And I recognize that there's not one secret ingredient. I guess if there was a end-all, be-all secret ingredient, it's treat humans like humans. And treat them valuably.
We're going to have to get you back on the podcast to do a full episode on that. Because seriously, it's actually a topic that, you know, we talk about a lot on the podcast.
Yeah.
And some of the things that you're talking about there, we really could go into a lot more detail. So I'm going to hold you to that at some point. But
yes, sir.
We're running out of time, and I just want to come back to Greenhouse Software now. Obviously, your mission there, as it states, is to help every company become great at hiring. How do you do that?
Well, I think the first thing is realizing that the greatest access to helping humans become more successful in the way that they navigate this world is typically through their career. The average person spends 90,000 hours working. And so for us, the way that we try to help people get better at hiring is, number one, recognizing that a lot of companies right now don't hire very well. They have a process that's full of bias. There's no structured interviewing. They're asking questions that in many places and countries are illegal. And so what we try to do is, number one, make the barrier of entry of applying to the job, democratize the access to these jobs. So we have one of the easiest applications on the planet. If you apply to any of the nearly 8,000 customers that Greenhouse has, very easy for them. So lower the barrier for candidates. And then on the back end, making sure that recruiters actually have a tool that they like to use, one that allows them to look at people with a host of different backgrounds, a host of different skills, and try to figure out how do you ask them consistent questions that are not rooted in bias that'll help uncover the skills or the value that they can unlock for a company. So
tremendous. Donald Knight, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat, and good luck with tomorrow. I know you're going off to Transform next, so good luck with that, and most importantly, good luck with the new baby, and congratulations again to you and your wife and family. That's fantastic.
Absolutely, Russell, man. Thank you for having me, for real, and shout outs to Remote as well.
Tremendous, thanks.
All right, later.
Joining me now is Jean Arne. She is the head of partnerships at Remote. Jean, it's lovely to see you here today.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
I would love to hear your backstory to start off and how you came to be in your position as head of partnerships at Remote.
Yeah, I joined Remote 3 years ago, really brought on to build out the strategy, build out the team, build out all the different partner programs. And previously I was at Checker. Okay. I led partner acquisition there, and I've always been very keen on working for companies that were very mission oriented. I don't know if you know a lot about Checker, but it's an API first background check company. And it was all around demystifying background checks and making sure that we eliminate bias in the background check hiring process. And so when I was looking for the next company, I couldn't pass up this opportunity where, when I interviewed with Yob, he had mentioned, you know, we really want to live out our mission at Remote, where we want to hire from so many different countries, remote countries, every corner of the world, and really identify opportunities for talent. Mm-hmm. And he said during our interview, you know, it's funny, we even hired an engineer from Kyrgyzstan. He's like, you've probably never heard of the country Kyrgyzstan, but he probably makes more than his entire village, and he never had to leave his home country. And what he didn't know is that I've actually been to Kyrgyzstan.
That's crazy.
About 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It was so serendipitous. My friend was directing and producing a film.
Okay.
In Kyrgyzstan, in Bishkek, and also the outskirts, uh-huh, where it was very, very remote. And yeah, I remember I spent a week there traveling all around, thinking, wow, it's so beautiful. There's so many natural resources and a place I've never been before. Mm. But so remote. This is probably the most remote country I've ever set foot on.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that we're able to connect Kairat, who's still at Remote till this day, after 3.5 years, an opportunity to work at an amazing company like Remote, and really building out a company where we have different perspectives and so much diversity. it's truly bringing so many different melting pots of cultures and music and backgrounds together, which builds a much stronger company in my perspective. And so I knew it was too good of an opportunity to pass up.
Yeah. Tell me now a little bit more about your role as head of partnerships. What does that entail, and how excited have you been to kickstart that for Remote?
It's been such a fun, wild journey. I mean, over the past 3 years, being the first partnerships hire, figuring out the product market fit for how we want to build out the partner programs was a really fun challenge. I would say in the first few weeks, I was probably introduced to 80 different prospective partners from Yob and Marcelo and all the different executives early days. And getting on those calls and really understanding the needs of their customers and figuring out what the ideal partner profile is, from affiliates to marketplace to integration partners, that really helped me build out the strategy for what we want to deploy first next 3 months to what we want to build out in the long term. And so what was really fun about this role was I was given the opportunity to not only build out the strategy, but also share the strategy with all of our top investors and have them poke holes and share feedback and see what I'm missing and see if this is the right strategy for us to execute on. Yeah. And getting their approval and blessing. And one feedback that we got from our investor was, you know, building out our own API was part of our long-term strategy, something that will take a lot of, you know, product and engineering effort to build out. And he said, why don't you start building that out now and make that a key differentiator and partner with all of the domestic payroll companies and offer what we do at Remote. You know, at the time it was core employer record services, and really tap into that market at scale. And so fast forward to today, we have a large API partner program. It's very robust, and we were able to launch with Gusto. It's called Gusto Global Powered by Remote, where we tap into 300,000 small, medium businesses that are already on Gusto and now looking to hire outside of the US. So they're able to do that through Remote, all on the Gusto platform, now in Canada, and will be in many other countries by end of year.
That's awesome. Okay, so what's next then? Tell me about where you think this program could go to. I mean, I'm sure you're planning ahead. But talk to me about maybe the next 12 months, but beyond that as well.
Yeah, for partnerships, we're looking to onboard another 1,000 affiliates.
So
that's a large channel for us.
Yeah.
This is our scale channel, where we have influencers, content sites, lots of different deal discounts where they're promoting Remote on her behalf to their audience. And so that's a big initiative for us to truly go beyond US to EMEA and APAC countries and onboard another 1,000 affiliates and really scale out our referral channel that way. We are also working with a lot of VC partnerships. So we have our own investors as well as 200 other VC partners globally, where we want to support their portfolio companies and continue to offer very exclusive discounts and just top-notch customer service to our VC partners' portfolio companies. So doing a lot of events. We just had a Gangels social event last night, and we're also doing a big General Catalyst dinner at Transform. And so doing a lot of these local events with our VC partners to gain better understanding of what their customers need is a big focus for us as well. And then with technology partnerships, there's a lot of integrations that our customers have been requesting with Workday and Xero, and also expanding the country coverage with Gusto Global.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, and I imagine you mentioned there about the global expansion, so, and the events. Do you plan to go to events, you know, in EMEA and beyond there as well to further build out this program?
Yeah, I have a fully distributed team.
Yeah.
I have folks
as you'd imagine, yeah.
In London, yeah, Isle of Wight.
No way.
in Berlin, in Sweden, yeah. And also in the States. And so we kind of divide and conquer and make sure that we have a lot of partnership representation at all of our global events. And also doing a lot of regional events. Now that Marcelo is based in the Bay Area as well, just getting him in front of a lot of different speaking engagements at our VC partners.
Okay. And final question, with all those distributed teams and the people in the Isle of Wight and all the rest of it, what's the culture like between you all, and how do you build that and foster that culture?
I think we have a really unique culture on the partnerships team and partner marketing team. We had our first in-person offsite,
right,
where, you know, I'm from the Bay Area and some folks are in Europe. So New York was actually the perfect middle ground.
Yeah.
And we had a few folks, you know, based in New York as well. And so it was an amazing time for us to get together for two whole days. We had Marcelo in town doing a speaking engagement at Two Sigma, and just building a culture where even if we're asynchronous and we're remote, we also do have a small budget for social events for the team. So for example, every quarter I would want to have a recap of how our business has been performing and also do a fun event, whether it's an Airbnb virtual experience, and really continuing to invest in more of the social bonding, team bonding events.
Yeah, sounds great. So wish you all the best of luck with that. Jeanne-Anne.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now is Briaretta Calloway. She is VP Global Marketing and Communications at Mass Challenge.
Yes.
Briaretta, nice to see you here today.
I'm so thrilled to be here, and the fact that you all are doing all of these interviews in the middle of all of this chaos is to be commended. So.
Yeah, we really appreciate you stopping by. So, well, tell us about this talk, because you've just come from it, haven't you?
Yes.
It's on equity and inclusivity in the corporate world. And I was really interested in the term you use in that, the invisible pathway to promotion. Tell me more.
Yeah, this really came as a result of some research that I was doing, really trying to understand, well, what are the barriers to career development for Black and brown folks in corporate America? And what I found is this sort of prevailing thought, which is that there didn't seem to be enough transparency on what is it that I need to do in order to advance my career. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talked about in my session this morning is that right now, much of the efforts around inclusion and equity is really, in my opinion, too dependent on a few folks who really feel strongly about DEI, which is like amazing, but it's not really good for sustainability and scalability.
Yeah, yeah.
So really, this invisible pathway to promotion is just my way of articulating that we need to create greater transparency on what are the steps that it takes in order for someone to grow their career so that we can take it out of the realm of like this goodwill effort and just make it something where equitably folks can access this information and grow their careers in any way they want to.
Sure. Now, how you kind of bring this to life, and I think you're doing this in a superb way, is using personal stories.
Yeah.
So tell me a few of those of the BIPOC workers that...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things. I often say, if I were to describe the work that I'm doing, it's really called data storytelling, right? So to me, in my mind, I love data. I think it's really compelling, but it doesn't hold the same importance as really hearing from the folks who are experiencing it. So one of the stories that I often talk about is this worker that I'll call Rachel, late 20s, just leaving college, has a degree in software engineering, is really looking to grow her career. And really, I find her story fascinating because she represents like a growing population of BIPOC workers who aren't necessarily so concerned about diversity. They really feel that on the merits of their education, their skills, that they really can grow their careers. And then oftentimes what happens is that they have this momentary interaction that really reminds them that there is possibility for bias and barriers to growing their career. And I talk a little bit about Rachel's journey in that she has this moment where her colleagues are sort of heckling her, really questioning her abilities and skill. And over the course of 18 months in following her in my research, you find that she's really struggling with lack of confidence, with really feeling included, a sense of belonging. And so what do we do for workers like that who are really interested in growing their careers, but also having a sense of belonging in the places that they're working? And so I think a story like Rachel is really compelling because it's so prevalent to have like a momentary interaction that doesn't seem like, quote, a big deal.
Yeah.
And yet the impact of that moment really, especially for marginalized workers, can really have longevity in the impact that they have for these workers. And so what do we do, not just from a culture perspective, but what interventions can we put in place for those workers so that they can navigate through some of these difficult moments?
Yeah. Well, that leads me on to the next question. What, you know, what should we do? How do we get that greater inclusion? What, you know, what measures can we introduce that, you know, because we've talked about these issues so much, you know, this is now about, you know, actually trying to make a difference. So what can we do?
Yeah, I think your question is the right one, because one of the things that I sense is like a growing sense of fatigue around these discussions. It feels like, my goodness, we've been having these conversations forever. Why can't we seem to see like scalability in the success? For me, it's really contingent on a couple of things. I think the first is I really believe in sort of de-emotionalizing DEI work, right? Like, this isn't the work of a few good people who are trying to do good work. It's really about building in concrete steps. So in my session, I talked about there are some really sort of like standard things that we know to be true about growing your career. You have to be good at what you do, skill development, networking is really, really important. You also have to have mentorship and sponsorship. Also, this idea of seeking opportunity, how do you find the right projects, opportunities to sort of position yourself, and then visibility and recognition. So to me, that's creating that transparency, right? Like, these are some of the core things that you need to do in order to position yourself for promotion, and then building interventions around that. And I actually talk about a little bit of a case study of an experiment that I've been running for the last year, where I have built a program that has very specific interventions around these core tenets, so that folks can get the skills that they need to grow their careers. And I'm really excited to share that after a year, we're really starting to get the metrics that show that folks are actually finding career advancement.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. There are positive steps being made. I guess a bigger part of this as well is recruiting and finding the best talent for the business, doing that in a fair and equitable way. How do we do that?
Yeah, and this is really at the core of why my session was called Beyond Tokenism, because one of the things that I think is critically important is that what success looked like 10 years ago is not what it looks like now, right? Like 10 years ago, to see a few black and brown folks in a few positions felt like success. Yeah. It's like amazing, we're starting to see diversity. Now, 10 years later, when we see one or two folks sitting in these very like visible roles, which is one of the key tenets of when you know something is like tokenism versus like real diversity. So to me, it really is, how do we get to a place of true meritocracy while acknowledging that there certainly is bias in a lot of these processes? And I think, again, it really is about transparency. It really is, well, what does success look like in this role? What are we looking for agnostic of the human that it comes in? And can we articulate that in a way that feels broadly applicable? So some of the work that I do, I help folks like degender their language. There's certain language that we use that actually is more appealing to males versus females. There are certain job descriptions, when they read it, you almost get the implicit understanding that they're looking for like a guy versus a girl to run this program.
That's crazy,
and so just like helping people, I really believe in like helping people like decode their own bias, right? Because I think the thing that people are afraid of, like the worst thing you could be called in the world is like racist, right? So nobody wants to be called that, but then it sort of robs us of the truth, which is that we all have bias, right? Like, we're all struggling to unpack some of that stuff, so let's not be afraid of that. Then let's just work on like, how do we create the most equitable opportunities for folks, and then get super clear about what success looks like so that folks can actually articulate that. Because right now, what we see is that growth for some populations is too contingent on someone else telling me that I did a good job. I should be able to have clear insight into what success looks like and advocate for myself to say, you said these are the success metrics, I've done that. So I feel positioned for career growth and advancement.
Listen, you mentioned fatigue earlier. You certainly haven't got that fatigue. Your energy is very inspiring. So, Brighter Calloway, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Such a pleasure.
So we're now joined by Chris Appleton, the founder of Art Pharmacy. Chris, you spoke on a session about social prescribing. So, first of all, I'd love to understand exactly what that is. And maybe you can give us a bit of background to its use as well.
Absolutely. Social prescribing is a practice by which healthcare providers prescribe social care. So what if your doctor could prescribe participation in the arts or in exercise, nature, food? So that's what social prescribing is all about, is the prescription of non-clinical care.
Great. So how does that work in practice at Art Pharmacy then?
Art Pharmacy is a startup company that works with healthcare providers, health plans, and individuals with mental health concerns. We specifically enable doctors to prescribe participation in arts and culture activities that have protective and therapeutic benefits to their mental health.
Okay, so what are some of the positive impacts that, you know, you've witnessed with the patients that you've worked with?
You know, one of the big problems in mental health services is that people generally don't like to engage in the care that's available to them. Nobody wants to be on an antidepressant. Most people don't like sitting in therapy for 50 minutes on the couch talking to their therapist. But people really love to participate in these types of arts and culture activities. And so we've seen really high engagements with our patients in their care plans, which is really crucial to driving clinical outcomes and also reducing the cost of care for healthcare providers, for health plans. So we see high engagement rates. In fact, adherence to our treatment is nearly twice that of antidepressants. And we see wonderful clinical improvements in patients with depression disorders and anxiety disorders that come into treatment with ART Pharmacy.
So how many people are at ART Pharmacy, and how many patients have you had come through so far then?
We have a team of about 15 people working for ART Pharmacy.
Right.
On our team. We have literally thousands of arts and culture partners that work with us providing this care in their community to members.
Are you quite unique in this field then?
We are. Social prescribing is a somewhat novel concept here in the United States. It's been around in the UK since the early 1980s, but there's a growing movement here in the US to bring social prescribing to the States.
Okay, so you mentioned your team that you've got at the moment. In terms of how you're growing as a business, looking at your website, it said that the attributes that you look for among potential recruits are value, trust, impact, listening, creativity, and collaboration. How do you attract the best talent to come to ART Pharmacy?
We like to work with people that want to solve problems, that want to solve really hard problems. The US healthcare system is broken. And we have many different stakeholders, from the health systems and providers that provide care, our employers that essentially pay for our care, Medicaid and Medicare, federal government, regulators, all trying to work together to serve patients. And so people that want to dig into the specificity of the problems, I think all too often when problems are big, we generalize those problems, but really the problems are very specific. They're not general. So people, we work to attract people that want to get into that specificity, that are curious, that want to peel back layer after layer after layer and understand the problems of the stakeholders that work in our ecosystem, and then help solve for those problems.
I'm just intrigued, actually. Do you personally have a healthcare background, or was this just something that you saw and you were passionate about and you wanted to get involved in?
I'm very passionate about mental health.
Yeah.
It's somewhere that hits really close to home for me. Personally, I have also witnessed the way that that the arts have impacted my life, played a really important role in my own mental health and well-being, and spent my entire career watching the power of artists to heal.
Yeah, that's great. What's the plan for the future then for the business?
We're growing rapidly. We just raised a round of capital and expanding throughout the United States and perhaps beyond.
I was going to say, will we see you coming over to Europe, UK, and further afield?
It's very possible. Let's hope so.
Well, listen, Chris Appleton, thanks for joining us. Good luck with that future growth, and sounds fantastic, all the work you're doing. So I really appreciate you taking some time to chat to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm now joined by Bobby Rossett, the founder and CEO of Virtual Gurus. Bobby, thank you so much for coming and have a chat with us. You've just come off stage from a session called How Female Entrepreneurs Can Dominate Tomorrow's Startups. Tell us how that went, but also, what common ground did you find with the other panelists?
Oh, thank you. This is great. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure.
So we talked about how women CEOs are paving the way and how we're dominating, but a little bit deeper than that, we're actually kind of trying to talk about how do we dominate further and get further into our businesses and continue the scale that we're at. I think almost all of us on there were over 60 million, around the 60 million range in revenue. So I'm a little bit lower than that, but it felt so good being on a panel of women that are doing good.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll get there very soon. How would you describe your own leadership style?
You know, I'm a very authentic and vulnerable type leader. I treat every single person at Virtual Gurus like they're humans, just like me. When I was starting Virtual Gurus, I really struggled with people taking me serious. They didn't think I could actually build this thing. I've gotten told it was not scalable, and, you know, so I tried to have my employees understand that, you know, we're all human, and, you know, we build and foster a really good culture at Virtual Workers.
Were there other barriers that you had to overcome in your, you know, kind of entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah. When I was raising my seed round in 2020, I went through 170 investors saying no to me, saying I was not scalable.
Wow.
And now, you know, I'm the first Indigenous woman in Canada to close our Series A funding round, and I'm working on Series B right now.
Congratulations on that. So hang on, you got to 170 saying no.
Yeah.
Surely at some point you're like, this is not going to happen. What kind of kept you going through that?
You know, the first 10, 15 no's, they got me angry. I was mad, sad. And then after, I just let it fuel my fire. I was like, you know, you're not going to say no to me. I'm going to go and I'm going to grow and you can't stop me. So I kept going.
Did you get feedback from them? Does that like, and did any of them give you the feedback, and did that help you in terms of the next meeting and the next meeting? I mean, I admire your perseverance.
Yeah. I always get feedback no matter what, even if I know they're not the best investor for us. However, there some of the feedback why they were saying no, you know, it wasn't good enough for me, if I could say. Like, they say you're not scalable. Well, we were bootstrapped to $1.8 million in revenue at the time. You know, and so how can you not be scalable if you're at that?
Yeah.
You know, so I think now, though, a lot of them are kicking themselves now for not jumping in.
I'm sure. So you've created the Virtual Gurus community. What kind of culture are you trying to, you know, create and foster there?
You know, I'm trying to create a culture and a whole community of underserved folks who have been told no, just like me. So all the people that work on our platform have a story. They could be single moms, they could be veterans, they could be prison workers, landed immigrants, people with disabilities, LGBTQ folks who are transgendering or transitioning genders and they can't find a job. All those people work on the platform and they have a story. We're able to provide meaningful work from home opportunities to them through the platform, which helps us keep them in their communities and keep them home where they're safe.
That's great. And now I just want to go on to this other area that you're involved in, because as well as Virtual Gurus, you're the chairwoman of the Board of Indigenous Prosperity Foundation. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that, and also, you know, why that the foundation and the work you're doing there, why it's so important to you.
Yeah. So the Indigenous Prosperity Foundation is a collective where we're trying to raise money so that we can give back and give get more young Indigenous entrepreneurs out there building their businesses. We need to inspire them, give them money, but we need to do this without taking equity. In Canada, obviously, we have the Reconciliation Act, and Indigenous people have often been overlooked. And one of the things we don't want to do is take equity from them to give them money. So we've built up the Indigenous Prosperity Foundation through NACA, which is an Aboriginal association in Canada. And they recruited me to be the chair. I didn't think I was going to have the time for it, but, you know, here I am.
Well, that's brilliant. That's listen, good luck with that. That's great. That's great work that you're doing there, and also, obviously, with the Virtual Gurus community. But for now, Bobby Rossette, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, joining me now is Robbie Cabral. He is the CEO and founder of Benji Lock. Robbie, lovely to see you here at South by Southwest.
Hey, thank you very much for having me over. Have an amazing booth and amazing energy here at South by Southwest.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. Now, you spoke on a session, didn't you, here at the event called How to Build and Protect Your Brand from Startup to Scale-Up.
Yep.
Quite a grand title. But tell me about your journey at Benji Lock. How did you first maybe come up with the idea?
Oh, wow. You know, just like every other person in the world, I'm a believer that if you have an idea, whatever it is, whether it's you're writing a book, creating a product, just write it down and put all your energy and effort into it. And if you find a solution to a problem, go for it. So in my case, weirdest time of the year, I started going to the gym at night, and one gentleman left the key inside the locker. So then I'm looking at all this in front of me, and he's kind of complaining to the manager that, hey, I can't open my locker. And then they have to come in, bolt cut it, break the lock. Long story short, locker is broken. He's happy because he had his key and all his stuff that it was inside the locker. But then the manager is not happy because the locker is all broken. I'm looking at all this in front of me, and I'm like, wow, how come there's not a lock that you can open with your key, but also with your fingerprint? And that's how the Benji Lock idea started.
Awesome. Now, it's all very well having that great idea.
Yep.
But how do you then turn that into a viable brand? I'm sure there's a whole history of great ideas that didn't actually make that next step. So how have you managed to do that?
Exactly. Well, I'm a believer too in execution. So I thought that when the idea started, you know, you may not be the best at, for example, I used to be in a band back in the day. So I used to sing a little bit, you know, but I was not the best at playing piano, playing guitar, playing drums. So I said to myself, if I want to create a product, I got to find the right team, you know, find the right graphic designer, the right patent attorney, the right product developer. And that's how I kind of envisioned creating Benji Lock. And, you know, based on what we spoke yesterday at the panel, alongside the USPTO, the SBA, and the copyright of the United States, it was more that how do you create an idea, but also from an intellectual property perspective, get your patents, get your trademarks, and then now you start launching your brand. And I kind of took those first steps first and then brought Benji Lock to market because I felt that you have to be protected legally to put that your baby out there in a way, you know.
Yeah. And look, every startup has challenges along the way, don't
yes.
they? What were some of the ones that you experienced?
Oh, wow. Getting on a lot of no's.
Yeah.
You know, when you knock on a lot of doors, people will say no, no, no. But I'm a believer that it only takes one. And, you know, that's why I like shows like this, like South by Southwest, because Benji Lock started in a show called CES. Mm-hmm. Same thing. And you show your idea, you show your product, you show your innovation, there might be 100 people that will say no, but then it only takes one to say yes.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the journey. Someone say yes, we partner with a company, we license the technology, and then also that's kind of how the whole Benji Lock also appeared on that TV show Shark Tank. It was kind of putting yourself out there, and people will kind of see you, discover you, and you do the best you can to take it from there. So.
Yeah, I was reading about Shark Tank. Tell me about that program. How does that work?
Well, in my case, I was at a trade show as well. They had a casting call. I decided to do it. And then I kind of forgot about it. Months later, I get a call and say, hey, Robbie, we like your product, your story. Would you like to do the show? And I said, yeah, why not? You know, I'm a believer that don't put all your eggs in one basket. So I said, let's do it. So months pass, and while I'm working my idea and all that, they gave me a call and say, hey, it's time for you to go and step into the show. So I stepped in. It was exhilarating. It was scary. I remember I actually didn't eat for like 2 days. But I think it really helped me a lot because I never saw the show. Since I'm originally born and raised in the Dominican Republic, it wasn't really my cup of tea of watching this show. But when I stepped into the tank, I was kind of really myself. I showcased myself, my story, my product. And out of the five sharks, four say yes. And in the end, I went with Kevin O'Leary. And to this day, we're partners.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, that's such a great story.
Yep.
Now, with any business, it can't be a one-man band, can it? You can't do everything on your own. You need to bring people into the business. So really keen to find out from everyone here at South by Southwest, how do you attract that talent to the business?
Yeah. Well, one of the first things that I really love is trade shows. Believe it or not, I know that trade shows could be expensive for startups. I know it, but it's a opportunity for you to meet talent, mm-hmm. to meet opportunities from business and all that. But in reality, meet talent. So much talent comes in and says, hey, I'm a product developer. I'm an engineer. I can help you with this or I can help you with that. I'm a person that, you know, I love Zoom and all that, believe it or not, but I love the whole personal relationship that you can build with someone by shaking hands, by looking at them. And so that's one of the opportunities that I really love. Shows like this, like South by Southwest, it's a potential for, you know, so much talent, so much creative. So it's one of the first things that I do enjoy, but in this world of day and age online, you have to use your resources as well. So,
and just finish up by telling me about what you're excited about Benji Lock. What's going to be happening over the next 12 months and beyond?
Oh, wow. Well, we're relaunching the brand with a new line of stainless steel products. Really cool stuff. I'll show you.
Yeah.
and then also, you know, as the future evolves, I know that the whole world of AI is pretty big now. But I'm a personal believer in that whole personal experience. There has to be that privacy. So, for example, for us, all of our products are non-connected. So it's very private to you. So I'm a believer of that. And that's kind of the new journey. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with it. Great to see you here today. Robbie Cabral, thank you very much.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I'm an honor and humble to be here.
Thanks so much again to all our guests who took the time to chat with us on Remote's booth here at South by Southwest.
Really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please do follow us wherever you get your podcasts and please do give us a positive rating and review.
Plus, you can find us on all the usual social channels.
And if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can do that via the contact form on the website at csuitepodcast.com. But for now, from me, Russell Goldsmith, and Graham Barrett, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.